Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
This week marks the anniversary of the start of the Korean War. Today's show offers two perspectives on that forgotten war. First, historian James Mattray looks at that period of United States history when Harry Truman was president. Later in the hour, Chico author and world traveler Alan Gazzetti recounts what it was like to be a soldier who found himself stationed in Korea during the early 1950s. Harry S. Truman's use of the atomic bomb was one of the most controversial decisions any American president made. My guest today has researched the impact of decisions made when Harry Truman was president of the United States. James Mattray earned his doctoral degree in U.S. history at the University of Virginia. In 2002, he joined the faculty at California State University, Chico, as department chair and professor of history. He is author of 7 books and numerous articles on East Asia and continues to research the Korean War. He served as chairman of a symposium in Key West, Florida, on the legacy of Harry S. Truman in East Asia, and co-chair of a second conference at the Truman Library in Independence, Missouri, New Documents and New Histories, 21st Century Perspectives on the Korean War. He has put together an anthology of the papers presented at these two conferences entitled Northeast Asia and the Legacy of Harry S. Truman, Japan, China, and the Two Koreas. James Mattray, welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You know, it must have been exciting to get together with other researchers who share your passion and compare notes.
Absolutely. It was terrific. Both of the conferences were wonderful, especially the one in Key West, where we focused specifically on U.S. policy in East Asia and were able to talk about a number of critical issues that Truman had to address during his presidency. The second conference was focused more on issues related to intelligence. In other words, specifically the question of why the United States was surprised by the beginning of the Korean War, and then, in kind of doubling down, surprised when the Chinese intervened in the Korean War. And there, the papers that were delivered were focused more directly on that.
And I'll bet you learned things you didn't know before because facts that weren't not available, that had been classified, top secret. So I think that would be another exciting thing, that documents have been declassified that allow you access to information you couldn't have before.
That's certainly the case, particularly in two areas. One is, of course, with respect to communist documents. One of the real flaws in the research and the writing that was done on the Korean War for many decades was that researchers didn't have access to any significant extent from the other side of the story. And that began to change in the late 1980s, particularly actually China took the lead, not so much with releasing documents, but many direct participants in the decision-making published memoirs or collections of papers. And as a result of that, researchers were able to get tidbits of primary source documents from the Chinese side. But then everything really changed with the fall of the Soviet Union. When that occurred in 1991, the new government of Russia under Boris Yeltsin, trying to curry favor with the South Korean government, released a number of documents related to the beginning of the Korean War, which were critical in demonstrating that the Soviets definitely played a direct role in the planning and the implementation of the beginning of the war, which had been an extraordinary source of debate for a long time, and that really put to rest that particular issue. And then more documents came out of the former Soviet Union thereafter, and all those documents, therefore, were critical in being able to produce the new material that was published in this anthology that just came out a couple of months ago. And then very quickly, there also have been more documents that have come out on the U.S. side with respect to intelligence, particularly from the Central Intelligence Agency, which previously had been classified.
And you mentioned memoirs, and I noticed a couple of times that things that you and historians now view as significant at the time, for example, when President Truman was writing his memoirs, he didn't really go into much detail about some of the things that you now consider quite significant.
Absolutely, and there's a real laundry list of issues that have been focused on much more directly and in detail now as a result of the new materials that we have at our disposal. I think one of the things that I've pointed out in my writings in recent years that I think is a quantum shift in research on the Korean War is that for the first two decades at least, central to the story of telling of the Korean War was the role of General Douglas MacArthur. But frankly, MacArthur's role now in the research and writing on the Korean War is really quite secondary.
Well, speaking of MacArthur, I want to talk about the cover photo. My guest is Professor James Mattre, and his book is Northeast Asia and the Legacy of Harry S. Truman, Japan, China, and the Two Koreas. Describe this cover for the listeners.
The photo on the cover is actually quite a famous one. It's a photograph of President Truman with General MacArthur at the famous meeting that they had on Wake Island in the middle of the Pacific, October 15th, 1950. This particular photo was the one taken just before the two men left, departed from Wake Island. The discussions, of course, focused on a number of different issues, but it was the first and only meeting between President Truman and Douglas MacArthur, and later became a source of considerable controversy amongst historians. Indeed, it was even the case at the time as to the motivation behind the meeting, what was discussed, how the two men interacted with one another, and what impact it had, of course, on eventually the subsequent decision by President Truman to recall Douglas MacArthur and relieve him from his command responsibilities in the Pacific.
Well, one thing, when you look at the photograph, here's the president in his hat that men wore in those days. This was, again, in the 50s. He has on a suit and a tie. Here is General MacArthur looking off, not at President Truman. Neither of them are looking at each other, kind of looking off in the distance, no tie, kind of an old beat-up hat, which would be appropriate for a general to wear. But that wasn't the only, in subtle ways, showing disrespect to the president, I think, for the way he's dressed. But then you should salute your commanding officer, not shake hands with him as an equal.
Exactly.
And of course, MacArthur was not Truman's equal. He was superior.
Now, that how the two interacted with one another was really the focus of much of the early writings on the interaction between the two men and how they interacted when they met each other personally on Wake Island. In fact, there was a legend that held for a while that MacArthur's plane had arrived almost simultaneously with Truman's, and he didn't land. It was the legend. It was a myth because he wanted to make sure that it would be Truman who would be greeting MacArthur. But historians know now from the historical record that that's apocryphal, that in fact MacArthur had arrived before the president. The president landed after him, and then as he, of course, came down the stairs from the plane, he was greeted by MacArthur, who rather than saluting his commander-in-chief, instead shook hands with him. And of course, later in his memoirs, Truman made a point of arguing that that was typical of the disrespect which MacArthur had shown to him, not only previously, but during this meeting and then subsequently. Although it's interesting because he also reports in his memoir that they had a very amicable meeting with one another, that he found MacArthur, as he said in his memoirs, interesting, which of course is subject
sounds
to
like
different.
Sounds like a euphemism.
Exactly. Whereas MacArthur in his memoirs said that he liked Truman from the beginning, was found to be a very pleasant and enjoyable individual to be with. So one wonders, of course, what was really going on in their minds.
My guest is James Mattre, and he is the editor of an anthology, Essays on the Legacy of Harry S. Truman. And MacArthur did not single out Truman as an object of disrespect because it went back to Roosevelt. He was not respectful to President Roosevelt or the Emperor of Japan. I mean, it wouldn't have hurt him to show respect to the Emperor of Japan, to tell him goodbye when he was leaving Japan.
Yes.
So MacArthur has this, he doesn't like authority, and he doesn't want to show respect to authority, whether it's the emperor, whether it's the president of the United States. But one that just was galling to me as an American was what he said about the Japanese people when he had come back to the States. And he said, oh, the Japanese are like a boy of 12. And they had loved him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like a slap in the face to these people who had adored him, wanted to build statues and memorials to MacArthur.
Right. Well, the article you're referring to in the anthology is written by a very highly respected specialist in U.S. foreign relations named Sayuri Shimizu Guthrie. And her article is very interesting because being that she is a native Japanese, she's Japanese American, she was able to go through the Japanese newspapers at the time and provide insights in an area which previous historians hadn't looked at. And that was, we certainly know in detail what the reaction of the American people and American politicians were to the recall of MacArthur. But we don't know, didn't previously have works on, how the Japanese reacted to his recall after they had come to, as you've already suggested, to adore him, to really idolize him, to look at him as almost kind of a faux emperor during the time period that he was in Japan. And what Dr. Shimizu Guthrie shows is that when he left, MacArthur just didn't demonstrate the kind of respect for the Japanese to reciprocate the respect that they showed for him. Now, I'm sure you could probably in some respects understand that given the shock that he experienced and having been removed from his positions and going back to the United States. But his reaction also was, I think, a reflection of what emerges in many of the other articles in the anthology. There are 15 in all, in which historians have shown that MacArthur had this regal attitude about himself, that he was in a special class above everyone else. And of course, that contributed to an extraordinary sense of a self-rightness, of a kind of a righteousness upon his part, in which he believed that he was a person who didn't make mistakes and that he was all-knowing and omniscient in his knowledge about the issues that he was involved in. He certainly considered himself to be in a class by himself in being able to understand East Asian people and their culture. And of course, we know now, as a result of a number of works that have been done on him, biographies and the like, that indeed his understanding of East Asia was fundamentally flawed in many ways.
My guest is Professor James Mattrey, and we're talking about his collection of essays on the legacy of Harry S. Truman. And when I was reading the chapter on Truman and MacArthur, I was thinking, gosh, if I was a Hollywood producer or director, I would be all over this topic. I would be making a movie about these two, and especially MacArthur. Of course, this was done some years ago, 1977, and you may have seen this movie, MacArthur, with Gregory Peck playing the General MacArthur. I do have a little trouble with the same guy that was in To Kill a Mockingbird, this wonderful lawyer that Gregory Peck played in To Kill a Mockingbird, then playing this character that is not a very sympathetic character when we know more about him. But I understand there's another movie going to be made coming out that it's in post-production now. So I'm very interested to see how they treat the subject, because I understand there's some factual errors in that first movie that was made.
Well, I saw the movie a long time ago. I haven't seen it recently, so I don't recall that much about it. But I think that one of the things about MacArthur is that with so many controversial individuals in history, he elicited extreme responses. His adherents certainly shared his exalted image of himself, and his detractors certainly focused on those elements and aspects of his character and his career, which were quite negative. That's the kind of individual he was. I think the historical record, though, has made it plain that as the one essay in the anthology demonstrates, his military record was not nearly as flawless and as exalted as his adherents would have you believe. I mean, in World War II, for example, at the beginning when Pearl Harbor was attacked, one of the reasons why the Japanese were so easily able to occupy the Philippines was because of foolish tactical and strategic decisions. decisions that MacArthur was responsible for making right at the beginning of World War II. In the Korean War, you can think of at least two examples almost immediately of really ill-advised military decisions he made. One was after the United States defeated the North Koreans as a result of his Incheon landing, which of course individuals have pointed to as his great victory and masterstroke in the war. Instead of immediately sending forces north into North Korea, which was a decision that was made by the Truman administration, he instead took the forces that had landed at Incheon and put them on ships and sent them by sea around the southern coast of Korea to the other side of the peninsula to land at Wonsan. And this took more than a month. And so as a result, while all that was going on, the relocation of those troops, the Chinese had begun to intervene in the Korean War and put themselves in positions, of course, to spring an enormous trap on U.S. forces with huge casualties. The other decision that he made was to maintain that divided command. The United States had the 8th Army to the west, and they had the 10th Corps to the east, both advancing to the Yalu with no communication between the two of them or coordination, which some military historians have argued contributed to the military collapse that followed. So those are just two examples of decisions he made that I think reflected his overconfidence, his arrogance, his belief that he couldn't make mistakes, and it cost lives.
Well, you know what was the scariest for me was MacArthur, and this is something he didn't do, but I feel like it reminded me of Kennedy and Cuba, how close we came to nuclear war. And I don't think people realize how I felt from reading this. We were so close to World War III if MacArthur had gotten his way.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And indeed, the new research that has been done by historians and the new documents that have come out over the last 20 to 25 years, that's one of the areas, I think, where much of the revealing information about the war has really shaken up the scholarship on the conflict, because it's always been viewed as a limited war, that the administration was wanting to make sure that it didn't escalate towards a world war, let alone to a resort to nuclear weapons. But we know now from the research that's been done, particularly during the 1980s and published works in the 1990s, that the administration seriously had under consideration the use of atomic weapons in the Korean War from the moment that the North Koreans staged their attack on South Korea, and that indeed linked to this is that the common assumption has always been that Truman relieved MacArthur because he wanted to assert civilian control over the military, which is a central premise of our democracy. But we know now from the documents that one of the other major reasons for his decision was that the United States was seriously considering being prepared to use atomic weapons in response to a possible feared major offensive by the Chinese in the spring, April of 1951. And they were very afraid. They'd already relocated the Joint Chiefs of Staff on nuclear weapons into the Pacific, and they were preparing for the contingency that this might be necessary.
The B-29s were ready.
That's correct. And as a result—
And MacArthur had the targets picked out, 26 targets picked out.
He was all ready for it. And what the Truman administration was afraid of was that if they had a commander in the Korean War who they didn't trust to use that power wisely, that might result in the provoking unnecessarily of a nuclear exchange. And so one of the reasons why, and I think this is my own personal view, I think the most important reason why the Truman administration decided to relieve MacArthur was because they needed to have a commander-in-chief who they could trust not to create an incident and then use power which was set up as a contingency, only in a worst-case scenario, to try and fulfill his own objective, which was to try and take the war to China and to destroy the new communist regime in China, which had been a long-standing objective of MacArthur since the communist triumph in 1949.
My guest is James Mattray, and we're talking about the legacy of Harry S. Truman. And speaking of Truman and the fact that he didn't want World War III, going back to the end of World War I, I was impressed that President Truman took, and I'm sure others, took a careful look at the mistakes that were made at the end of World War I and the treaty at the end of that war, which didn't end things. And he paid attention to those lessons in concluding and bringing peace at the end of World War II.
Yes, one of the articles in the anthology is written by a highly esteemed professor now, emeritus at University of Southern California, Roger Dingman. And he writes an article in this anthology entitled Truman's Gift. And the gift that he's referring to is the peace treaty that was negotiated with several nations were participating in this, but the United States really was the main author of this document, which was done in consultation with the Japanese, and it was agreed to at a peace conference in the fall of 1951, bringing about the formal end of the United States occupation.
Repeat that year because people think, oh, the war ended in 1945. We had VJ Day. And there's not even agreement exactly when people celebrate VJ Day. But 1951. So this was not right at the end of war.
Exactly. The United States was in occupation and ran Japan underneath MacArthur until his relief in the spring of 1951 when he was replaced by Matthew B. Ridgway. And then Ridgway was then the commander-in-chief and the head of the occupation. Final details were put together on the peace treaty, which was put together primarily by John Foster Dulles. He had been brought into the administration, leading Republican advisor on foreign relations. He was brought in to build bipartisan support. And, of course, that's another example which links to what you talked about earlier. In World War I, at the end of that conflict, Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat, didn't consult with any Republicans in the putting together of that treaty. Truman learned from that mistake because it resulted in the defeat of the Treaty of Versailles by the United States Senate in 1918 and 1919. This time, he had a Republican specialist with close ties with the Republican Party be the main architect of that agreement to facilitate Republican support so that when that treaty was completed in the fall of 1951, it was easily ratified by the United States Senate, went into effect in 1952, and it was indeed 7 years after the end of World War II before Japan regained its sovereignty, but one has to hasten to add it was not complete independence because the United States also signed at the same time with the Japanese a military treaty which allowed for the maintenance of U.S. occupation forces in Japan, which of course continues to be the case to this very day.
Now, to end World War II, Truman, we just mentioned he's a student of history. He looks at the failed peace at World War I. He looks back when he's considering firing one of his generals. He looks back at what President Lincoln did when he was faced with an insubordinate general in firing McClellan. But now, when Truman was looking at to end World War II, he gets this visit from a previous president who says, okay, here's what you need to do, Truman, because I don't think people had a lot of confidence in this guy who's the accidental president who suddenly becomes president, doesn't know what's going on because President Roosevelt had not kept him in the loop. So Hoover comes in, and he gives a lot of advice, but one of the things that seemed to stick with President Truman is there are going to be a lot of lives lost if you don't use an atomic weapon, if you don't end this war. There's going to be so many lives lost. And I think that then President Truman was paying attention to that.
One of the things that has always been emphasized in works on Truman when they look at his background is that Truman was an amateur historian. He prided himself on having—
Because he didn't have a college degree.
No, he did not. In fact, before he entered the United States Senate in 1935, he had had a very, very poor record in terms of his individual life's pursuits. He had started, a clothing business in Kansas City right after World War I, which went bankrupt, and saddled him with major debts. It's interesting, I think, and to his credit, that he spent his years thereafter, paying off all those debts to the last penny. One thing about Truman that I admired was he was a man of high integrity. He cared about what other people thought of his commitment to, as the saying goes, you know, I say what I do and I do what I say. And certainly that was true of him. But he also considered himself to be a real expert on history. The problem was he frequently, even though he read a lot of history, drew some rather inaccurate lessons from history. Although I think by and large, I think the fact that he did read a lot about history certainly was a positive thing about him. But I think you're absolutely right that he was president when he became president suddenly in the spring of 1945. He had no experience in foreign relations whatsoever. He hadn't been consulted by Franklin D. Roosevelt. Here was a man who really in many respects was thoroughly unqualified to be president of the United States. But he was determined to rise to the challenge. And in my introductory essay in this anthology, I give a mixed judgment on his legacy in East Asia. As the title of the article is, I'm mild about Harry, because he made some very important large decisions, like using the atomic bomb to end World War II and save many lives. But he made a lot of foolish, smaller decisions, such as crossing the 38th parallel in the Korean War. If that decision hadn't been made, the war would have ended more than 2 years earlier with the loss of a lot fewer lives to arrive at the same result. The reference you were making to was to his meeting with Herbert Hoover. It had to do with the focus of the first article in the anthology after my introductory piece by Mark Galicchio from Villanova University. And what he's talking about there is the issue of unconditional surrender and the question of why Truman refused to allow for the Japanese to keep their emperor as a condition for them making peace. And his main argument is, as we know from history, that Truman insisted upon unconditional surrender, made no concessions on keeping the emperor, but in the end, in fact, he did. And one of the reasons why that was done was because it was believed by keeping the emperor in place, that would encourage support amongst the Japanese people for U.S. occupation, leading towards eventual restoration of their sovereignty. And on that point, Truman was absolutely correct. Galicchio's article, however, is focusing more on, and this is it's a fascinating article because his argument is that he, Truman, saw the necessity in this particular case to have unconditional surrender leading towards the foundation for a major overhaul of Japan, what he calls a New Deal for Japan. And one of the reasons why the Republican side wanted to instead not have this was they hoped to prevent major reforms in Japan. So it's a very interesting article, and I encourage individuals to buy the book and take a look at the article.
Well, I was so impressed with the fact that here, just a few years before, we hated the Japanese. We hated them. They were vicious. They were less than human. And just in the space of this a few years, Truman played a role in helping turn that around. I'm so impressed with that, and I think it's a lesson for all of us.
Absolutely.
My guest has been Professor James Mattray. Thank you, Professor. His book is Northeast Asia and the Legacy of Harry S. Truman, Japan, China, and the Two Koreas. After a short break, I will ask local author and world traveler Alan Gazzetti what it was like to be a soldier on the ground during the Korean War. His memoir is No More Smoking in Bed. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today was born into a large family of East Coast Italian Americans at the beginning of World War II. By the end of the war, Alan Gazzetti had moved with his family from New York to California. He traveled to Japan and Korea when he was in the Air Force and continued to travel the world during a career in high technology. He has written three novels and a memoir of his life as a corporate world traveler, No More Smoking in Bed, True Adventures of My Life. Alan Gazzetti, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. I'm pleased to be here.
You know, the name Gazzetti is rather well known in Chico.
I'm aware of that, yes.
So, and you talk about food a lot in your book because the Gazzetti here in Chico is synonymous with good food.
My nephew David, God bless him. He's a wonderful, wonderful chef. And yes, he's gained quite an appreciation for food, and he's become a master, as has Woody, his son. He's become a masterful chef. And I just moved to Chico eight months ago or so from Riverside County, and I love it here very much.
We all do.
Yes.
Well, I mentioned that you were not by profession a writer. You had this whole other career. So at what point did you decide, I'm going to write a book about my life?
I guess I was carrying this manuscript around for 6 or 7 decades. I didn't start writing until I was 67.
You mean carrying it around in your head?
Carrying it around in my head, yes. The initial motivation for writing the memoirs, which was my first book, No More Smoking in Bed, came from my daughter Gina. For a lot of complicated reasons, I didn't meet Gina until she was 14 years old. We became very close and are still today. And at one point, she asked my older sister, Anna, a strange question. She said, who are we anyway? You know, my dad and I talk a lot, but I don't really know anything about the paternal side of my family. Who were my grandparents and what were they like? And, you know, we talk a little about that. So I got to thinking about that comment and I thought, you know, I'm not going to be around here forever. I better sit down and document this. So I sat down and I started writing this book and it just poured out of me. I just, memories kept flooding back and I just continued to write. I wrote 7 or 8 hours a day for, 5 months or so. It took me 4 or 5 months to write this book full time. I just couldn't stop writing, and I was very excited about it. And then I gave it to her and my granddaughters and a lot of other friends and relatives, and people seemed to like it. So that's the way it happened.
My guest is Alan Gazzetti, and we're mainly talking about his memoir, No More Smoking in Bed, True Adventures of My Life. And these adventures started, I mentioned that you were growing up on the East Coast and in a rather large family, and you were the youngest.
I was the youngest of 7, and I think I was a mistake. I say that because
or my surprise.
Yes, a surprise. I say that because my father was in his early 50s by the time I was born. My mother was a few years younger than that. And, you know, that caused me some – there were advantages, but that caused me some problems, particularly through my tender teen years. You know, I was kind of embarrassed to have old parents, particularly since they were both from the old country. They came over in steerage to Ellis Island. And so they were old-fashioned Catholic Italians, and they had a slew of kids. And I had 3 brothers and 3 sisters. Some of my brothers and sisters were from his previous marriage. His first wife died, and then he met my mother, and she had 3 more children. So around 1944, 45, toward the end of World War II, he made a very brave move, in my opinion, and he decided to move the family to California from upstate New York. We lived in Utica, New York. We had a 39 Chevy. The boys were all in the Navy, and my older sister Marie and my other sister Anna and myself and Mom and Dad piled into the car and drove for 9 days from upstate New York to California. And I remember a lot of that trip. I stood up most of the way. I was so excited as a five-year-old boy.
And you've loved traveling ever since.
I've loved traveling ever since. I was just born to it, I guess. And my older sister, Marie, kept a journal and accounted for every penny that we spent. Now, my mother brought a lot of food with us. We cooked a great deal. She always cooked in motel rooms and that sort of thing.
And this was the early 40s, but still, I think people were shocked at what it cost for this family to travel from one coast to the other.
That's correct. I don't remember what gasoline cost in those days, but it was probably 20, 25 cents a gallon. And I don't know what kind of mileage the old Chevy got. I remember going over some harrowing passes in the Colorado Rockies and where the roads were literally one lane. And if you, at 10 or 11 or 12,000 feet, if you came up against another car coming the opposite direction, one of you had to back up to let the other guy go.
Because this was before the interstate system was put in place.
It was frightening for my mom. I remember her crying and screaming a lot, and I remember my dad saying, "That's okay, calm down. We'll get through this." You know, he was a rock. So we finally got to California, and my sister said we spent a total of $109 on the entire trip, which is amazing to me. I don't know what that is in today's dollars, but it isn't more than $700 or $800, I'm sure, maybe $1,000.
So when you were writing your book, you had access to some records, like your sister, the record keeper. You knew how much this trip across country had cost.
Yes.
And so I would imagine other family members, as they would read your manuscript, or I guess it's not really a manuscript these days, what you had typed up, and say, "Oh, but you know, Al, you remember," and they would probably spark your a recollection of other things.
Exactly. I got a lot of feedback from my brothers and sisters and a lot of corrections because my memories weren't that accurate in some cases. Yes, and they were very, very helpful.
Well, so when you say true adventures, you know that it is as true as it can be because you had other people helping you.
Well, first of all, if you're going to write an autobiography, you want to be truthful about it, and you want to be as accurate as you can. So I did do a lot of research, and I only wrote down what actually happened, as painful as much of it was.
Yeah, because some of your story is not very flattering to yourself.
No, not at all.
But you were truthful, and I think that's why you said the value of doing this is being as truthful as you can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, so you got to California. You're still a kid, and you're living in California.
Yeah, I had a great time as a kid. I grew up in San Jose in the Santa Clara Valley, and in those days, all of what is now Silicon Valley had a population of 78,000 people, small town. The entertainment that my family got was jumping in the old Chevy every Saturday and Sunday and driving out to some cheese factory or to a farm and pick tomatoes on the vine and, you know, that sort of thing. That's where we got a lot of our foodstuffs, locally grown organic product. And it was just like Chico became a few years later.
Well, before you even finished high school, though, you were getting itchy to leave and go out and see the world. And joining the Air Force was a good way to do that. But you weren't even old enough to join yet.
I had a couple of buddies. One guy that I hung out with from another high school, we met when we were 14 years old as caddies at the San Jose Country Club. And then we kind of hung out throughout high school. Another guy was a guy by the name of Robert Graham. His name was Pena at the time. He changed it to his mother's maiden name later when we joined the Air Force. He became an incredibly famous and incredibly wonderful artist, a sculptor, painter, and left behind an enormous body of work. I'll talk about him in a little bit if I may.
Well, you know what? You did say in your book that his artistic skills came in handy as you were almost old enough to do things, but didn't quite. Your ID didn't say
that. We met a couple of other high school kids when we were 14 and a half or 15 years old, and they got us into jazz. I became a jazz aficionado at age 15, as did my buddies. So much so that Bob, who was a great artist, as I mentioned, took our California driver's licenses. I guess we must have been 15 and a half or 16 because you couldn't get a driver's license until you were 15 and a half in those days. And he took the driver's licenses, which were in negative form in those days. They were black with white type. They were negative. So they were pretty easy to doctor up, and he changed the dates on them so we were 21 years old. We'd drive up to San Francisco, go to the Black Hawk on Turk and Hyde Street, and there would be the Dave Brubeck Trio or Quartet, and Paul Desmond on sax, and Cal Jader on vibes and drums, and all these wonderful Mongo Santa Maria, all sorts of wonderful jazz musicians, and we'd go sit in on that stuff on Saturday nights. Had a great time.
You know, I might mention, too, that this artistic friend that you had, Bob Graham, and you remained friends throughout your life.
Yes.
But he grew up and married Angelica Houston.
That's correct. Yeah. That was about, I think, his third marriage. And they were married 16 years, and unfortunately, he passed away of a very rare disease about 2 years ago, two and a half years ago, called Wegener's. But anyway, yes, and he threw a lot of wonderful grand openings and parties and one-man shows, and wherever I was, if I could, I'd fly down for them. And when I lived in Southern California, of course, I could drive. He lived in Venice, California, and built a home for Angelica that was just very unique. I won't say magnificent. It was very artistic and very different. Rather small, but it was a courtyard home, and it had a strange little 3-foot-wide, 40-foot-long swimming pool that they use for a lap pool. And adjacent to the courtyard was another property on which he built a 10,000-square-foot studio. See, what he did is he bought the entire city block, raised everything, including a Bank of America, and kept the vault from the Bank of America. And that was in the basement of his new home as his private vault.
And he was particularly talented as a sculptor and even as a youngster
yes.
when you were growing up.
Just to mention a few of his works, just so people can relate, he did the nude torsos at the Los Angeles Coliseum in 1984 for the Olympics. He did the Olympics gold medal in 84 and the U.S. silver dollar for the Mint. He did other monuments, the Duke Ellington Memorial in New York City in Central Park, the Charlie Parker Memorial in Kansas City. You see, he was a big jazz fan also. He did the Joe Louis Memorial in Detroit. He did a couple of presidential memorials, including the FDR Memorial, or at least he participated. He was one of five artists who did that particular memorial.
My guest is Alan Gazzetti, and we're talking about his memoir, No More Smoking in Bed, True Adventures of My Life. And I mentioned that you like traveling, and you thought that Japan, if all in the world, that Japan would really be an exotic place to go. So when you join the Air Force...
At 17,
off you go to Japan.
That's correct. I loved it. I thought Japan was just the most exotic, wonderful place, and I thought I was going to get to spend several years there. I was there just, a few months, and they all of a sudden I got orders to go to Korea. I ultimately wound up doing my time in Korea and extending my tour so I could go back to Japan, and I did do that. So I was able to spend more time there.
Well, you know, Alan, when I was reading your section about Korea and you were describing the tents you were living
yes,
in,
yes.
And as each word I read, I thought, boy, this sounds just like what we know of the set of MASH, the movie that was set, movie and TV series.
They were the same tents.
And then you said they were. So I had a very clear picture of what you were describing, except the intensity of the cold. I don't think the movie and the TV programs about the Korean War get across that.
I later was transferred to the state of Maine, and I thought that was pretty chilly, but it was nothing compared to having to live in Korea in a winterized tent. The tents had wooden frames, and there was plywood up about 4 or 5 foot level, and then there was an area of about 3 more feet where it was just screened, and then in the wintertime you pulled the canvas flaps over those screens and the wind would come whistling through there anyway. We had 2 pot-bellied stoves in each tent. But unfortunately, the oil for the carburetors in those stoves was in a 50-gallon drum outside of the tent, and it got so cold that the oil would freeze, believe it or not.
And that here you are all bundled up in every piece of clothing you could put on your body, blankets, and freezing.
We knew it was coming. When it was a particularly cold day, we knew that night was going to be pretty miserable. So everybody put on their parkas, their Arctic gear, mukluks, and parkas, and we all had 7 or 8 blankets. And we'd go to bed with the stoves roaring away, knowing that those stoves were going to die out in a few hours. And when they did die out, we'd all lay there, and there were 3 or 4 guys in each tent. We'd lay there and chatter until somebody had the guts to, or was miserable enough to get up, go out and get an axe and open up the cover on the oil and smash the ice and get it running again. It was horrible.
So these were your adventures in the Air Force, which you seem to, other than the fact that it was very cold in Korea, you did seem to enjoy your experiences. Then you come back to what became Silicon Valley. It wasn't then.
Yes.
But you were really positioned in just the right place at just the right time. And you got a job with Lockheed. And it sounds the most wonderful story. That you got this wonderful high-tech job at Lockheed when we really didn't know what high-tech meant.
That's right. It was, it was mid-1960. One of Bob Graham's buddies from the service got me the job, and I got a job as a digital computer operator initially. And we operated what were second-generation computers. UNIVAC 1103s is what they were called, but they were 27-ton monsters. You could literally walk around inside them. They had vacuum tubes that were 4 and 5 feet high, and they were so slow by today's standards that literally a Christmas card that plays a little tune has 1,000 times more power than those things had in those days. But, you know, that's the way computers were in the early days. And what we did, I was at the Palo Alto Scientific Labs for the first year or so that I was at Lockheed, and we ran 13 Discoverer unmanned launches from that facility. They launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base and other places, but we tracked them. We had a group of scientists and mathematicians that would put in punch paper tape and cards as input, and they would track what they called ephemeral data, an item in place in a particular place in space, and try to predict when and where this capsule that was orbiting would retrofire and return to Earth. Well, the best we could do was come within a couple of 100 miles of where it was going to land. So what was funny about that was the way they recovered those capsules was absolutely incredible. There were C-119 flying boxcars. They were twin fuselage planes that dragged 100-yard-long nets and swarmed around in the sky like a bunch of flies and tried to net these capsules when they would come in. They actually, out of the 13 launches, I think they caught 6 of them. Some of them went into the drink, and they were able to send frogmen in and put flotation gear around them. They didn't have self-deploying flotation gear in those days. And they were able to salvage a couple more, but we lost a few of them. Anyway, it was about 30 years later that I realized what we were really doing on those unmanned launches. Ostensibly, at the time, we thought we were practicing to put a man into a capsule and send him into space, which, of course, we were doing. But there was a secondary purpose that we didn't know about.
In fact, you referred to it as a secret mission.
It was a secret mission. Turns out that when the Cuban Missile Crisis came about and JFK and Khrushchev went eyeball to eyeball, and Khrushchev blinked, as they say. The reason we were able to get so much data on the missiles in Cuba and all the launch sites and all the equipment and such clear pictures was because they were taking pictures from those capsules that were orbiting around the Earth back in 1960. We didn't know that.
My guest is Alan Gazzetti, and his book is No More Smoking in Bed. And he gets out of the military, gets this job with Lockheed. And this, as I mentioned, you have positioned yourself at the start of this new technology. So your skills were in such high demand that you really climbed fast, and you were getting promotions, traveling all over the world. It sounded like a very glamorous existence that you had, but I could see how it would be very fatiguing.
Yes, it was a few years after the Lockheed experience that I wound up with a company that was sort of a little Cinderella company. It had a product that the market and the world really needed, portable data entry terminals. There was no such thing until then. This was in the very late 60s and early 70s. That company just exploded. You know, we became very successful, and I moved up in that organization very rapidly. It was wonderful. Until I actually got to a point where I was director of international marketing, and I was responsible for 5 subsidiary companies in Europe and a number of distributors in other parts of the world. So I traveled constantly. I was out 3 and 4 weeks at a time, traveling all over. But the exotica wears off after doing that for 2 or 3 years, living in hotels, spending time away from home, being very lonely on a weekend when maybe your business associates were with their families and you had nothing else to do except be a tourist. It all gets very old.
And you reach a point, say in your book, the facts of life are that when you work for anybody on a W-2 basis, only one of 3 things will ultimately happen. You may quit, you may die, or you may be fired. Only in the first instance are you operating from a position of strength. So I let this happen to me.
Yes.
And then what did you learn from that?
Yeah, I got fired. It's basically after 7 or 8 years of being truly successful, a new president came into the company. He brought in all of his cronies. He got rid of all the existing vice presidents and director level guys, and I was one of them. And I got fired. So that's when I realized that as much as corporations sell the idea that you're a team and that you're
a family
and that they really love you, they couldn't care less about you. When push comes to shove, it's all numbers.
And so you say that you would never, never again believe that a corporation could really care about its people. And so you say, I vowed to spend a significant portion of every day relaxing and treating myself well.
Yeah, I thought about that statement I made, and it sounds rather cynical, but I truly believe it. And so you're right. I mean, you know, what better things can you do except take care of yourself and make sure that you have peace of mind?
Well, in the process of traveling all over the world, though, you ate at some rather exotic restaurants.
Yes.
But you know what? I was intrigued. Then after all those restaurants that you ate, the place in your book you say, the best meal in my life, turned out to be spaghetti with a vegetarian sauce.
Well, that was on a trip in 1999, not that long ago, to Israel. And I think it was my last day there, I decided to take a tour and from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem in an air-conditioned bus with a group of other tourists. And we spent the entire day walking around Jerusalem, and it was just a marvelous experience. But after a few hours of that in the heat, we were starving, and in spite of the fact that everybody was instructed to not wander off from the group, a couple did. So there we were sitting in the bus waiting for a couple until 2 p.m. and not having had lunch yet. So finally, when we were able to get something to eat, it was vegetarian.
Finally, food.
Yeah, yeah. And it was the best. And that cold Carlsberg beer, I remember that as well, and it went along with that lunch. It was the best meal I'd ever had in my life. I never was so hungry.
I'm talking to Alan Gazzetti about his memoir, No More Smoking in Bed, True Adventures of My Life. As people read your book, if they're more or less your age, they remember things. Well, they remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. And they also, people here in the Bay Area. Well, I, actually, the year the earthquake hit the Bay Area, I had been living in California. I went to the East Coast for just that 1 year, and I remember exactly where I was when I saw the TV monitor, and they said there's an earthquake in San Francisco. Of course, they didn't know at that time what was really happening, but where you remember where you were.
Yes, I had moved back to San Jose from Orange County, and it was 89, and the World Series was beginning that particular day, and I wanted to get home from my office in downtown San Jose to I had a sales job, and I wanted to get home in time to see the series, and so I left at 4:45 or something like that. Got home to my little townhouse that I was renting. Left the garage door wide open. It was, you know, it was up, and I went through the garage, through the patio, into the house. Turned the TV on, and just as the TV warmed up and came on, the images on the TV were moving all over the place, and my house was shaking all over the place, and my refrigerator, which I was standing next to it, started to tip over, and I was holding it up and pushing it back, and the whole place was just rumbling and rocking and rolling, and it was horribly frightening.
Because there's no place to run.
Place to run. My brother, Pat, lived about two blocks away, and as soon as it stopped shaking, I ran out through the garage, which was still open, to go over to his house. I was going to drive, except that I saw people driving on the street with their eyes wild and wide open and cars careening all over the place, and I thought, I better not get in my car and try to drive in this stuff. So I ran over to his house.
Another of your, and most of your adventures took place all over the world, but this adventure was right there in your own house.
Yeah.
Well, the title of your memoir is No More Smoking in Bed, and people wonder, well, where did that title come from? So before we finish up your story, tell us briefly why you named it No More Smoking in Bed.
Well, it's a metaphor. My brother Pat, you know, my nephew David Gazzetti, it was his father, Pat. My brother Pat was about, I think, 19 years old. He married very, very young when he got married the first time. I think he was 19, and the marriage didn't last very long. And so he was 20 or 21, and he'd been away from his wife for a few weeks, living back with my dad and mom and myself in the old house on North 15th Street. And so one day my dad came into the room and wagged his finger at Pat and said, I want to talk to you, son. No more smoking in bed. Pat said, well, what? I don't understand what you're talking about. He was wagging his finger at him, and he, master of the metaphor, said, you know what I'm talking about. No more smoking in bed. Well, that's how I came up with the title.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Alan. My guest has been Alan Gazzetti. His memoir is No More Smoking in Bed, True Adventures of My Life. I would also like to thank my first guest, history professor James Mattray, author of Northeast Asia and the Legacy of Harry S. Truman, Japan, China, and the Two Koreas. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.